Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your co-host, Big Waz, aka Wazzy Lambre. Nando is vacationing on the coast of Spain. He's going to be gone for 2 weeks while he is jet setting in Europe. I think he's going to stop in Ibiza. He's doing all kinds of jet setting, you know, impresario type of things. But we got a wonderful guest, man. Want to welcome back to the show my brother, Bertrand Cooper. You've read him in the New York Times and Current Affairs. He's a former Woke Bros guest. Bert, welcome back to the show, brother.
Waz, thank you. Thank you for that intro. I feel real special, but yeah.
Nah, man, I'm really excited to talk to you because, you know, I remember reading your joint in Current Affairs and just being blown away by, like, just the astute observation about how elites basically get to shape the dominant narrative of what's Black culture and how annoying it can tend to be, and how, you know, elites just flatten Blackness and how ridiculous it is. But currently, man, you recently had a very fun exchange on Twitter, which is the main thrust of why I wanted to have you on today. You had a very fun exchange on Twitter with a guy named William Sandy Darity Jr. He's a professor. Is he a professor of economics at Duke?
Oh, this could, I believe he's economics, although he operates heavily in sociology. He's really at that intersection.
Okay, he's at the intersection of economics and sociology at Duke University. He's a big deal in, you know, Black elite academic circles. I mean, once you're like a big deal at Duke and you're Black, you're going to be a big deal in Black academic circles. That's just how it goes. Like, the bigger your title, the bigger you are. And you guys had a pretty cool exchange. And you know, I just want to sum it up for the people where he was just basically like, yo, class don't explain race. All right, so shut up. You class reductionists, you idiots. Class doesn't factor in race. It's a waste of our times. And plus, once you look at the racial wealth gap, you see that race is everything, Bert. Like, race is the number one indicator of everything. Never mind that dudes like Darity get to even be professors at Duke University at all, right? Like, never mind that. It's race, right? Right, Bertram?
I mean, that's what I learned from that exchange. I mostly came on here as kind of a, you know, first stop on the apology tour. Like, I had it wrong, you know. 100% race. This is all my plot, just to come back here and tell you I made a mistake. You can't even read that CA piece. Just throw that shit in the trash, man. But no, this was a really interesting exchange for me, just because so Darity is a second generation Black academic. So like, he's mm-hmm. a professor, his dad was a professor, and he's been writing about this, you know, the racial wealth gap for a long, long time. Many folks will have seen his name paired with Derek Hamilton and a few other collaborators. If you've seen the racial wealth gap depicted, you've probably seen his work, you've seen him cited. He's both a source for The Atlantic and has gone to write for them before. And so the entire grounds of the racial wealth gap conversation, it really rests a lot on how he frames it. And just stepping back from
How does he frame it for those who aren't really familiar with the conversation or the narrative, excuse me, around the racial wealth gap here in America and how nothing has changed since slavery? Right, Bert?
The framing is very easy to do. We do a race-wide median. So we take all the white folks, we take all the Black folks, and we say what the median wealth for both those groups are. And this changes depending on the year, because obviously how much people are making each year changes. But normally what you get is you'll be told that the median white wealth is around, say, $120,000, and the median Black wealth is normally around $10,000 or so, if we're going by these numbers right here. And then what's, you know, useful about Darity's work is that a lot of times, you know, he splits both Black and white folks into quintiles, which just means taking everybody and splitting them into five different groups so that you can see at each income level, okay, I'm going to take Black families that are earning between $54,000 and $74,000 a year and compare their wealth to white folks earning the same. And I'll see again that, you know, the white folks have more wealth, even though they're earning the same income. Mm-hmm. And when you're looking at this graph, the way it's framed is really, it is about a interracial comparison. The information you need to do a Black class comparison, we'll just call that out. It's all there in the same graph. I don't like making my own graphs because people are going to be like, yo, look at this, you know, light-skinned quadroon motherfucker making up his own numbers and shit. So I use other people's graphs so that there can be no debate about whether or not you trust the graph, because you're already trusting in these other arenas. So using Darity's graph, if you want to, you can do a Black to Black comparison. Now, this is how it's framed. Race-wide median, you know, white folks normally have about 10 times, somewhere between 10 to 15 times more median wealth than Black folks. Or they go income quintile by income quintile, white middle-class folks have several times more than Black middle-class folks. That information is all important. What I got to ask Darity on Twitter, though, was how come he doesn't formalize Black class comparisons the same way? Because what he said to me initially was he never denied that there were disparities between Black classes, but there's a big difference between denying something exists and actually articulating it in a way that says it's important and makes it, you know, understandable to people. Because, you know, he's doing these really simple calculations. Oh, white folks have 2 to 3 times more than Black folks at this income level. He doesn't do that with Black folks He doesn't do a really simple comparison. He doesn't draw attention to it. And when I asked him that, what he said to me is, it would be a misleading experiment to do that class comparison between Black folks. And it's misleading specifically because the overall Black wealth is so low. It's kind of like, what's the point of doing this Black class comparison? And we can dig into the why of that, but that's really the story.
Well, and I do want to dig into the why because, like, you know, I've heard that basically people are just like, people who are critics of this racial wealth gap analysis is like, 10 more Oprahs and we're basically closing this damn gap. and while also not fixing a single fucking thing for the greater white masses. I've heard that as, I mean, excuse me, Black masses. I've heard that as one critique. What's your main critique with the saliency of a racial wealth gap and why we should even be thinking about it, just generally speaking?
So something that everybody has heard before is not all Black people are poor. Not all Black people are poor. There's no point in saying that unless there's meaningful differences between Black classes. So let's get into it. And again, this is a graph from Daugherty's report 2015 called Umbrellas Don't Make It Rain. In that, he's got Black and white folks split into five different groups, each by quintile, by their income. All right, here's my main issue. When people, lay folks, people who don't study statistics a lot, are hearing, you know, this racial median, they're filling in the gaps. They're filling in, trying to be like, what's the point of this median? And they're assuming it's telling them something meaningful about the economic lives of most Black people. The issue is that a median just describes a middle of a range, and it gets less and less useful the wider that range. American income and wealth is a pretty wide range. So knowing the middle, the median of that tells you, you know, increasingly little about people living away from the middle. So you jump into quintile one. This is Black folks who are bottom 20% of income earners. They're in poverty. In 2015, the race wide, add up all the Black folks, the median wealth there was $7,113. The median wealth for the bottom Black 20% was $100. So they had 1.5% of the race wide median. The race wide median was 71 times what they had. You go up one more quintile. All right, this is going to be folks who are bottom of working class, bottom, you know, lower middle, if you want, teetering on the edge of poverty, depending on their family size, they do count as federally poor. They have about 60% of the race-wide median. So doing better than the bottom, but still only a fraction of what this race-wide median is presenting in Daugherty's report. Go up to Q3. This is actually the middle class. This is what everyone will consider middle class. In today's dollars, it's, you know, folks making between $54,000 and $74,000 a year, they have double the race-wide median. And that puts them at about 140 times the wealth of the, you know, bottom Black 20%. Go up to the next quintile. This is your upper middle class. This is the real sweet spot for Black folks going to Ivy League schools and whatnot. Once you get here, you're like $74,000 to $94,000 a year. And these folks have a median wealth of 42,000 at this time. So
wow,
six times the race-wide median. One last quintile to go. All right, so this is folks who in today's dollars, the top 20% of Black folks, they'd be making $100,000 or more. They have a median wealth, according to Daugherty, of around $140,000. That's their median wealth. It is some 20 times greater than the race-wide median. It is 1,380 times greater than what the Black bottom 20% has. And it dovetails very, very neatly with income data coming out of Pew around 2019, where from 1970 to 2016, Black folks at the top 10% of the income distribution were earning about 10 times more than Black folks in the bottom 10%. So that any given year, over the last 5 years, Black folks and Asians are vying for which group can have the most income inequality within the race. And just to frame these for people, because I'm throwing out a lot of numbers here.
Yeah, please frame that.
The gap between Black folks at the top 20% and the bottom 20%, the wealth gap between those two, it's 66 times larger than the gap on the white side. The gap on the white side between the top 20 and bottom 20 is considered serious enough to undergird that entire class conversation. It's serious enough to do Occupy Wall Street, serious enough to, in two different directions, create class sentiments that can power Bernie Sanders on one hand and Donald Trump on another. But a gap 66 times larger than that between Black folks at the top and bottom is misleading to cover.
So, man, there's just so much to unpack there, because I want to make it a little bit more plain for people who are listening to this. And again, like you said, might not be as proficient in interpreting statistics as others. To your mind, what does it say about Blacks and wealth and class disparities since the 70s, basically since post-civil rights era, right? Like, that's what we're talking about. Post-voting rights, post, you know, the war on poverty, post, like, highly racialized programs from the government to bring people into, you know, elite institution patronage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is the story of the statistics you just gave us just now, Bertrand?
For sure. So in most of us have experienced this, and you know, I'm assuming a lot of the folks who are listening to this have an understanding that my economic strength, my income and my wealth dictates my ability to take advantage of really most programs that you might even offer me. You know, it sets the grounds of competition. I'm going to get to the history, but we can jump to a real clear example real quick. If HBO decides to have a diversity initiative for writers, but they have no concept of class, it means that should a Black person from a poor family apply,
there's just no fucking chance they're getting that job.
Pretty much. They have to just apply in a class-blind program with somebody who may have, again, over 1,000 times more wealth than them. And that's going to play a factor in terms of, you know, whether they can take an unpaid internship that's being billed as an initiative to build, like, more Black folks in a program. But let's get into the history. Since we have been unwilling to deal with class at any of these points, like, we're not willing to articulate class, all of this whole history of programs being done for Black folks, they're almost always class blind, or to a large degree, they're class blind. And, you know, somebody that I reference a lot is William Julius Wilson. He wrote The Declining Significance of Race. His second book, When Work Disappears, was, I think you'll appreciate this, was part of the inspiration for The Wire season 2 or season 3.
Wow.
He's also considered, like, really the father of urban sociology. Grew up poor and Black. I want to say from Ohio, could be PA. Anyway, he's writing between 1978, 1983, he's looking at Black folks right after, you know, the passage of all this civil rights legislation, right on the other side of the civil rights era. And what he's finding is that when he goes into these poor Black neighborhoods, over 70% of the Black folks raised in this post-civil rights era are still poor. And they are the children of the poor families from before. And he puts this theory that, so essentially what happened is that all of these programs for racial uplift were designed specifically to get whatever Black folks they could in the door. And most of how this was done very often was through, say, like, I'll give, it's multi-factor, but one is federal jobs. It's, can you get a job at the post office? Can you get a job, you know, working government, anything, which for a variety of reasons are not always accessible to poor folks, particularly poor folks who may or may not have a record or may be living in a zip code that's considered undesirable when, you know, a future employer asks you why you're living. And this, in a whole number of ways, basically allows the, you know, all these packages for racial progress to be concentrated on the middle and upper class. William Julius Wilson calls attention to this. Nobody gives a shit. In the second edition of his book, he writes in the epilogue, when he brought this information to all of his colleagues, they pretty much said, not too far off of what I got on Twitter, with all Black folks struggling, like, why draw attention to this? It almost sounds like you're saying the Black...
But all Black folks aren't struggling.
Correct. That's true. I mean, a big thing to include in this, and this is for, you know, poor folks of all color, we can, for policy reasons, do a race-wide median. Like, I can say that the median wealth of Black folks is XYZ, but if I'm a broke person with 1.5% of that, I can't call up a wealthy Black family and be like, yo, can I get some of that Black wealth that we all collectively own? The same way that, you know, some white dude who's in poverty can't be like, yo, Bill Gates, can I get that sweet loan? Because this is the white wealth we all have access to.
Right.
There's some real gaps here in how we interpret this information. So, you know, you're going from William Julius Wilson pointing it out. Nobody cares. He has a protege named Patrick Sharkey who does the same thing, but for instead of just poverty and income, he does it for ghetto neighborhoods and finds that, you know, the very next generation, some 70+% of folks who are living in the ghetto now were born in it and their parents were living in it. We come up to the present. Raj Chetty gets to do this with big data, gets to have access to some 20 million de-identified like IRS tax records and track. Like, he's not even modeling. This is important for people to understand. He's not modeling. He's being allowed to track 20 million children and just tell you where they ended up based off their parents. And again, we're finding that 70% or a little bit over for Black folks, and I should say also for indigenous folks growing up in poverty, they're staying poor. This would be like mine and your generation, you know, more or less. Chetty was looking at folks born like right at the last minute of Generation X. So you get to this point where we have most Black people in poverty. They're going to be second generation at the least. Many of them are going to be third, fourth, fifth generation poor, going back to pre-civil rights. The only way I can think that you would address this is to actually acknowledge these class disparities.
Exactly. Exactly.
When you get told that they're not relevant, or that you're being a class reductionist, or you're not appreciating the way that race interrelates to all of these things, which is like,
that's not true.
Yeah.
You don't, because it doesn't take, like, folks gotta understand, it doesn't take a lot to intuit race's role in perpetuating the class norms, right?
Yeah.
A lot of it is you need this permanent underclass of Black people as a sign to the underclass of whites, like, at least you're not that. And look at that. Divert your eyes from the white people who are doing great. Stop looking at that. Start being grateful that you are not living in squalor like this group of Black people. That's the purpose of it. It's to perpetuate the same stuff, but keep the masses of the poor whites, their eyes off the ball. Like, no. You're looking in the wrong direction. The people with all the money, the people with all the power, all the influence. No, stop paying attention to that. Pay attention to this underclass and be glad you're not part of it.
And that gets to that idea of like psychological wages, where like instead of paying white trash folks like with actual opportunity, you pay them with the privilege of looking like the people who lead. And that's
what they
come by while they're living in, you know, squalor and other places. And I bring this up because a lot of times I got to look askance at people offering to me what seems like the very same deal for the Black poor, like the representation politics. Like, isn't this the bum-ass psychological wages that you pay to like a white half of my family? Like,
let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. My man Ethan Strauss, he said something brilliant to me the other day. He said representation politics is trickle down economics for libs. It's this idea that like it's just magically gonna touch you from the top. Like, yes. It's just gonna, all of the benefits that accrue to an already, you know, elite class of Black people, we're gonna accrue all the benefits to them, nothing to you, and then just by osmosis, it's just gonna touch you from that top, and it's complete bullshit. And, you know, and it's important what you're mentioning, because I do want to circle back to something. All of the programs that would have helped any Black people at all, even though they start to diminish the further and further we get from the civil rights, right? Like this, yeah. These sort of redistributive programs, like the more they diminish, the few opportunities that exist is basically just patronage into elite institutions, which by definition, there can only be a few slots. They're elite. Like, that's the definition of elite. Like, there's only a few. And so, like, all you get now is, like, and I use this as an example, a chick who gets to have a show on MSNBC, a black dude who gets to be on Goldman's board, a black dude who gets to work at Raytheon. Like, you get all of this representation shit. None of it is redistributive. And then again, this stuff gets reinforced because the only people with access to, and proximity to the levers of power, of course they're stumping for these programs and this patronage because they're the closest to it. So they are self-interested in being like, yo, of course what black people need is a black vice president. Of course what black people need is a black Supreme Court judge. That's what black people need. Black people don't need nothing else. We need to make these elite spaces more diverse and nothing else. Because if the opportunity to get there is just as hard for black people as it is for poor whites, the country is perfect. And the only way you can feel that way is if you are within close proximity of reaching those spaces. The only way you can feel like what black people are missing, the problem with the blacks, is that at my job that I get paid $150,000 to do, a white woman might ask me about my hair. That is what is afflicting black people. The only way you could think that is if you're in that space. You have to be self-interested in that line of thinking to even consider that to be what afflicts the masses of black people.
Hello, listener. Have you ever used ButcherBox? I don't know if you know this about me, but I used to be a butcher. I used to work at an unnamed grocery store. I used to be that tall man behind the counter in your neighborhood, cutting up meat and preparing seafood for you. And I know that it can be a stressful situation. I know that it can be crowded. You have to wait your turn. You have to know what you want. You feel rushed. Sometimes you might think that your butcher has a bad attitude. I don't know. Happened to a friend. Couldn't possibly be me. But that's why I love ButcherBox. ButcherBox brings you peace of mind. You can easily find high quality beef, chicken, pork that you can trust is humanely raised. There's no antibiotics or added hormones. There's the ultimate convenience of not having to deal with butchers or the crowded meat counter after a long day at work. It's delivered right to your doorstep. There's always free shipping and there's incredible value. You're getting really high quality products at an amazing value. You get exclusive member deals. You get recipe inspiration, guides, hacks. A little hack from my butcher experience, the petite top sirloin, which is about half the price of the New York steak, is a very similar cut with a fat cap on one side, and you get very good tenderness out of the petite sirloin. If you've ever been to a Brazilian steakhouse and you see them talking about picanha, that's the petite sirloin. With ButcherBox, I'm always prepared. I always have meat on deck for a grill and chill, a cookout, or just making dinner at home. And I'm saving a ton of money from shopping at the grocery store all the time. Now, I know what you're thinking. That's great, but what's my reward for signing up for ButcherBox? Well, I'm glad you asked, because if you sign up at ButcherBox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, you will get free ground beef for life. For life. Enough ground beef to fill the Nile, plus $20 off your first box. That's ButcherBox.com/dings.
And, you know, off your points, a lot goes into making those sort of calculations like possible. Like, even though I have this, you know, I honestly didn't know that Daugherty was going to jump in like that. I certainly didn't know that that was going to be his response to me asking that question. But, you know, I'm not going to assume intent on Daugherty, but his research is largely used as one of these tools that can be, that can make class meaningless among black folks, that can make it so that we maintain this idea that goes back a very long time, where you can have a Negro leader doing race relations, that like black people are so similar that as long as you get one black person, they're going to be attuned to the group. And Adolph Reed Jr. has written about this really beautifully on like Non-Site, but just to shout him out. But yeah, you have this system that runs based on you saying, if I get a black person into any of these spots, I can trust that they just speak for the group. And that creates a lot of perverse incentives. One, it incentivizes you to ignore class entirely, because, you know, Black America says class divided.
I just want to know how people can say to me that Michelle Obama has the same problems as a single mom in Watts. How can you, like, say that?
You can say it because people have worked very hard at pitching that idea to folks. Like, I'll give, you know, one of my favorite examples just has to do with incarceration that came up in the Twitter discussion. People still write about Black incarceration. They write about it as the Black problem. You know, they phrase it the way I did, these Black incarceration rates. When you look into the numbers, 8 out of every 10 prisoners is in poverty before they go to court. So we have 80% of this being harvested from one class of Black folks, but it's billed as a Black problem because it is advantageous to imagine that incarceration is just floating out in the ether out there, snatching Black folks at random with absolutely no concern for, you know, economic vulnerability. And if you can keep pitching that idea until eventually you have a white liberal populace who really thinks that all of these ills exist in the same space, because that's what they think. They think that one day you're ducking the police, ducking getting your skull cracked in, and the next day some white person at a coffee shop's trying to touch your hair, and that these are all happening at random in the same oppressive space, as opposed to, like, these are different lives most of the time. And anytime we've surveyed Black people on their experiences of racism and then divided by class, they report different experiences. They don't even define racism in the same way.
Yeah.
So.
And you know, I think it's, and Michelle Obama too, is, I think, instructive too, because she is from the South Side of Chicago. Definitely from a working class family, but definitely not from the poorest people of the South Side, right? So she went to school, she gets into Princeton or Yale, wherever the fuck she went, and now she's, you know, fucking Michelle Obama. And it's just this idea, I am one of you. Yeah. I come from these neighborhoods. I'm from the South Side, even though my experience is not that of, you know, somebody with a heroin addict pops and a mother who couldn't keep a job. That wasn't really my experience, but I'm from these neighborhoods. I'm Black. And so, yeah, I could tell you about the Black experience, Bertrand, in so much as there is a such thing as the Black experience.
That's so much of the problem, you know, and something that I try to touch on is, like, these folks are not taking the opportunity to carve out an authentically Black experience, identity that doesn't have to do shit with having a heroin addicted, like, parent. Like, you don't even have to play that game. You don't have to decide to say, oh, the only way you can be really Black is to put yourself in some proximity to Chicago South Side. Like, I would tell people, I want to say it's 60 minutes on Barack Obama during, like, his first run. And at that time, and this will be a shock to people who are, like, you know, younger, who are, like, full on Gen Z, but people used to ask questions about class and background really explicitly. So at one point, the interviewer just, like, what do you have to say? And he's talking to Obama, to people who don't think you're Black enough. And when they cut from that question to actually having Obama answer it, they make sure he's in, like, an SUV, that you got the South Side, like, brown brick projects in the background. And he's saying shit like, oh, nobody asked me that, you know, when I'm playing basketball or at the barbershop. Because what the fuck is Blacker than barbershops and basketball? So that's a great answer. And then they round out the clip with, like, asking Michelle, is she afraid, you know, that something might happen to, you know, Barack, like, he might get shot at some point. She's like, well, the reality is that, you know, Barack, as a Black man, can get shot any day. And it's like, dude. This is specifically built around, like, they know that for Obama to be treated as authentic by whatever the power structures are, they need to connect him with these stereotypes of, you know, playing basketball in the ghetto, getting his hair cut, chopping it up with all the other brothers, and that he's offering constant risk.
Singing Amazing Grace.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it is just as fabricated and ridiculous as, you know, when white conservatives who went to Yale have to roll up right. their chambray shirts and stand in front of a Coors Light factory as a jet flies off the background. Like, this is all performance. It's pageantry.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to get to the second, the, like, I think the more, like, in the ether part of this. And not that it matters, but do we think that, like, the black elites are doing this consciously? Or is it just you do what is in your self-interest to do basically no matter what? Like, how are we supposed to feel when Joyanne Reed gets on MSNBC and says black people don't care about healthcare? You know, like when she's talking about Bernie Sanders and, you know, his agenda ain't black enough as compared to Hillary fucking Clinton. Like, what are we supposed to think when the black elite moves in these ways where this guy's just basically like the distinctions amongst the classes of black people? Like this lack of just admitting that, like, the programs, the things that would have helped black people only helped upper crust blacks and nobody else. And, like, the importance of acknowledging that and maybe changing how we go about how we quote unquote help black people. Are they doing this consciously, or is it just like, yo, this is what people do when it's in their self-interest?
I put it in a few different buckets. Everyone who is like over 30 is doing the shit on purpose. You all remember Class of Black America. You watched the same shows that I did. You heard all the old black civil rights leaders shit on hip hop, saying we're not all poor, talking to class politics. You remember the respectability politics. You know it. If you are under 30, damn, the change in the landscape is such that I think you could be naive about this for a very, very long time. Like, you are being told really aggressively that all these forms of oppression really do exist in the same spot. Like, I was interested in this stuff. I was going to graduate school in 2014 around, you know, the second wave of Ferguson. Adolph Reed, William Julius Wilson, these other black dudes who knew more than me and had a class inflection, they're not part of the curriculum. It really was possible to not know, like, is my experience of poverty and what I saw really just, okay, this is South Jersey and it's not applicable to the rest of the United States? And if I hadn't, you know, been born in 88, gotten to watch all those shows, gotten to see all the old heads, gotten to see all the fighting in my grandmother's church about low-class black people, if all I had was what I was being told by, like, pop culture now, shit, I might believe it. I might believe that there's no real class differences among black Americans. And it doesn't help that when you're in those classes, this is another thing that, you know, was really profound for me, and getting to talk to Daugherty, like, the other side of, you know, 90% of poor black high schoolers not graduating with a bachelor's degree is that none of these folks have to articulate their opinion, their point of view, their questions to an audience of, like, a lot of black poor people would be like, yo, I call bullshit. Like, that's just nonsense.
I would love to hear one of these black elites or intellectuals or whatever use the term misogynoir in Brownsville, Brooklyn. It just wouldn't go over well. It just wouldn't go over well.
And, you know, the thing is, like, I would implore the audience, like, just start Google searching, like, surveys of black opinion so that you can see what the black population thinks. And there's times on this whole misogynoir thing, like, it's just relevant to me right now. It's like, I'm not always happy with the poor black response on these issues. Like, there's many times
I'm not happy. They got to do a little bit better at some of their conservatism, for sure.
And, they just have these surveys, like, really good ones that came out this year, where they ask different groups of black people, like, they'll ask one group of black people about another group, and they'll say, do you feel you have most or everything in common with this group, a few things, or next to nothing? And, like, something that's really funny is that even when they ask upper class, like, blacks, this is according to Pew upper class, so people probably in the top 20%, how much they have in common, like, do they have everything in common with wealthy blacks? And, like, most of them say no. So I don't know who they think the wealthy blacks are. But the upper class black people don't think it's them.
I love that. They think they have in common with, I'm always on the brink of being pulled over in my car. Yo, I had this conversation with my buddy who lives in my neighborhood here in the Valley.
Okay.
And I asked him, I was like, you've been in LA for a year and a half. How many times have you been pulled over? And he's like, Never. he's at a car the whole time. He's at a nice car. He drives a Lexus. I'm like, yo, how many times have you been pulled over? He's like, nah, never. But he used to live in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, which is like, it's one of those weird places where, you know, there are gentrifying ass blacks, which is what he was, plus the indigenous population of some cats that are living in Section 8. You know, you live across the street from basically a halfway house type of situation, right across the street from a condo, from a condominium. And so he was like, yo, at least two times a year I would get pulled over by the cops in Bed-Stuy. Like, I'm just looking for parking in my own neighborhood. And like two times a year. But again, where is he living at?
Exactly.
You know, the second you get to a spot where you're living at blacks who are all affluent, gone. It's fucking gone.
Tony Armour, you know, Nigga Theory has talked about this. He's talked about living in Black Beverly Hills in the way that his neighbors talk about his kids having friends out of like Watts neighborhoods and stuff like that. Like, the classism is real. And I try to be honest about, or at least in the writings that I'm doing, is like, I was in poverty. I was in poverty until I was 26. And, you know, these class terms, like, I use them because they're a language that can frame it, but I'm going to switch from that for a second. I was living on less than $20,000 a year, most years, up until I was 26. And then I got to have this massive jump to the middle class, basically doubling what I was making. If you know the value of a dollar, the difference between like living on 26 and living on like 55,000, it's massive. And then over the last few years, I've gotten to keep moving up in like an ed tech space, so that the last 2 years I just, and this is in part because I don't have children, but I'm in that top 20% now, where like I've crossed over into the six figures. There is nothing in my life at all that has any resemblance to being the bottom 20. Not a goddamn thing. Fucking nothing. I came into this with like an open mind. Like, I've always loved like the artsy independent films that are talking about existential angst. And I watched these from like a unique perspective in my teens. Like, I thought, okay, maybe if your life is good enough, long enough, you adjust and you start feeling, you know, suffering as acutely as these middle and upper class characters. And it just didn't happen for me. And I've been here for like 8 years. And like most days, like nothing happens. Like, I'm now on the side where only acts of God can harm me. Like, somebody gets cancer or I get it, or like I get hit by a car. But other than that, there's no resemblance here. And I wonder if like, I feel like if you've had that experience, if you've really had that, a lot of shit just doesn't make sense to you. You know, like how people forget about class. Other shit does make sense to you. I mean, and I'll say this is just my opinion, and it might be like very diverse among other people on the left, but like whenever people are like, I don't understand why the American middle class isn't more interested, you know, in doing X, Y, or Z. It's like, have you been here, bro? It is so easy to just be distracted by how nice everything is if you make it to some money in America. Like, I understand why
these folks are so oblivious. Yeah.
I don't support it, but it's easy to be oblivious when shit's like going this well for you. Like, to your point, your friend moving. I'm from like South Jersey, in a place that's like in bottom of the hill, landfill, boys home, county jail, and you know, projects. I must have been pulled over like 17 times the first time I got like my parking. I've had my car searched. I've been pulled out of that motherfucker. I moved to Van Nuys, California, which is a sleepy little suburb. I haven't had a registered car in 3 years. Haven't been stopped once. I will pull out anyone who wants to fuck with it. I'll pull the registration out. I will give you a copy. That's it. And I only got my California driver's license like a few months ago. The only thing I had, which I do care about, this is I had the insurance. So if I had hit anybody, you would have been straight. You would have been fine.
But right.
Mission lapsed. I'd be doing life right now.
Yo, I can't think of a more perfect way to end this discussion. Bertrand, motherfucking Cooper, my boy. Tell the people anything you got working on that they should be checking out. Tell the people they can find you online. Obviously, to me, you're one of my favorite voices on this because people just don't. I just think people just don't intuit these differences and why they matter. And who are the people who are constantly telling you that they don't? Okay. Who are the people who are constantly explaining to you that a Negro making 250 grand basically has the same existence as a Negro making 30? Like, just think about who's always the ones who are trying to drill that into you and think about why. But tell the people where they can find you, Bert.
All right. So, you know, I'm using Twitter for everything. So, like, if you just want to see my little random thoughts where I'm like upset about today's class news, you can go to Twitter. That's where I'm promoting the writing. I should have a piece jumping off the New York Times soon. Draft take a while. And then that's probably it. But you'll find, go to Twitter @_blacktrash. You'll see what I'm up to.
I love it. I love it, man. Everybody, make sure if you can, for a cup of coffee a month, go to patreon.com/countthedings. Support Count the Dings, all the other Count the Dings offerings. We'll see you guys next week. We're out of here. Peace.